You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Language of the Cosmos, translated by Agnes Schneeborg de Stuhr. This is Lecture 3, given in Christiania, now known as Oslo, on December 4th, 1921. The two previous lectures, which I was privileged to give here once again, covered important observations relating to the nature and destiny of the human being. What had to be considered was that the physical and etheric bodies of the human being are connected not merely with what we perceive here on earth as the external world, that this bodily nature can only be understood if we also recognize its connection with the starry heavens that surround us. We tried to clarify for ourselves how the realm of the fixed stars and the planetary spheres work upon the outer form of the human being, giving it its shape and imbuing it with life. Moreover, we tried to place before our souls how the inner spiritual essence, the individual soul spiritual core of the human being, can only be understood if we consider it in its relation to the world of the higher hierarchies. We also pointed out that this connection with the world of the higher hierarchies becomes especially noteworthy when we observe how through our physical life on earth we can build a connection with the spiritual world in a moral sense, in a religious sense, in the sense of love for our fellow human beings, and so on. And how in doing so we enable our own angel being to work in us in a way that makes it possible for our descent to the earth at the end of the life between death and a new birth to proceed in such a way that we can acquire the full essence of individuality and as a free individual take hold again of our human nature. And it was necessary to point out that if we have not established such a relation to the spiritual world during the previous incarnation, resulting, for example, in a purely external connection to one's nation, then this, in its extreme form, can lead to a more chauvinistic relationship with one's nationality. We can see, then, from such observations, that the life of a human being can only be truly understood if this life is also considered from its other side, that is to say, from the side of the existence between death and a new birth. Whenever we approach the inner nature of the human being, we must consider this life between death and a new birth. For life here on the earth is in fact a reflection of the life between death and a new birth. Living in earthly substance means having a bodily existence, and this bodily existence is merely an expression of what we have developed in the world of soul and spirit before birth. What we must acquire anew, what must be built up anew in our essential being, is the will aspect, and in a sense also the feeling aspect. The thinking aspect, which is tied to the head, is what we bring, to a large extent, with us from our pre-earthly existence in the spiritual world, namely, to the extent that our feeling is included in our thinking. Our thinking capacity as such comes into physical existence for us through birth and requires only that it be developed during this physical existence, or be allowed to be developed through education. But what we, in this new incarnation, acquire mainly through interaction with the outer world, namely the element related to feeling and will, must, for that reason, play the most important part in the field of education. For all this has a bearing on education. If as teachers and educators we fall short with respect to teaching children to think properly, then much may remain undeveloped, which, as a result of previous incarnations, could have manifested in these children. If, on the other hand, we are unable to be effective with respect to the realm of will and feeling through our natural authority, and our own example as teachers and educators, then we do not provide the children with the things they ought to receive in the physical world, which will have harmful consequences for their life after death. This is precisely what generates such profound pain today in anyone who is able to comprehend these things. In today's world of education, people insist again and again on the idea that an intellectual understanding needs to be fostered in the child in order to stimulate its faculty of thinking. Although it is true that much of what the child brings along at birth can be exposed by these means, this can only be of real use if the reality of earthly life itself is also offered to the child in the right way. That is to say, if we are able through our example and natural authority to develop in the child the aspects of will and feeling that are not generally recognized. Most of all, we actually harm the eternal life of the child if we do not cultivate feeling and will. Our thinking, which we bring with us at birth, comes to an end here in the material world. It dies with us. Only what we cultivate through feeling and will, even though this is then unconsciously permeated with new thoughts, we take with us through the portal of death. What needs to happen in our present difficult time is that religion, education, the spiritual life, indeed all aspects of life, begin to take into account the eternal nature of the human being, but not from the viewpoint of human egotism only. Religions today cater unduly to human egotism. On the one side, they encourage inertia by not motivating people to acquire insight into the eternal through their own inner efforts involving their feeling and will. And on the other side, they foster egotism by speaking only of an eternal life that will happen after death, not of the life that existed before birth, or more specifically, before conception, and has come down with us into the physical world. I have already mentioned earlier that in order to speak of this life before birth, one would have to turn to the selfless forces in human beings, whereas one is really only addressing human egotism when speaking of the life after death. And this speaking of life after death assumes, by its very nature, an egotistic form in the religious concepts of today. The idea is brought to people in such a way that it, above all, satisfies their yearnings. Once this kind of satisfaction has been instilled in people, resulting in a more egotistical soul life, the religions believe that they have done what is expected of them. But what must enter into humanity as a whole through a truly spiritual understanding of the world is that all of human life should be viewed in a way that is eternal, free of egotism, and be molded accordingly by those who teach and educate our children. Now this also has significance in relation to larger, more public circumstances. And I would like to speak of these situations in this third lecture here today. For it is absolutely necessary today that we infuse our actual life situation with what we acquire through anthroposophical knowledge about higher worlds, and that we know how to present it there. With respect to actual life, abstract theories are of little use. Life on this earth is very diverse, full of variety. If, for example, we look at the life of the various peoples with this in mind, it is not only obvious that people from India differ from Americans or from the English, but also that Swedes are often said to differ from Norwegians, although they live in such near proximity. It is simply a fact that we cannot let ourselves be guided entirely by general principles, that we encounter concrete, individual conditions everywhere, and that these must be considered as such. And it is these very conditions, these concrete, individual conditions, that will not be recognized unless we consider them from the perspective of the spiritual. People today do not really know the world. They talk a great deal about the world, but do not know it, for they are unaware that this soul-spiritual element extends into physical existence, and that it is the spiritual which ultimately rules this physical existence. This is why abstract, general principles will not make a difference in this realm. It is true that these abstract principles are often quite correct, but they do not help us much in understanding the world as it actually is. It is, of course, principally correct to say, quote, God governs the world, close quote. But it is not of much use, in light of the great diversity of the world, to simply say, quote, God governs the world in India, God governs the world in England, God governs the world in Sweden, God governs the world in Norway, close quote. There is no doubt that God governs the world everywhere, but in order to apply this idea to life in its immediate reality, it is necessary to know how God governs the world in India, in England, in Sweden, in Norway. It is necessary to identify, also in the case of spiritual observation, the prevailing concrete conditions in every case. Of what use would it be, for example, to take people to a meadow, show them a plant with yellow flowers and round petals, and merely point out, that is a plant, and then take them to a plant with thorns and pointy filamentary petals and say again, that is a plant? It would be much more meaningful instead to explain the specific distinguishing properties of each plant. But when it comes to spiritual matters, people have become so easygoing in the extreme that they are quite satisfied with general spiritual principles and only want to hear God governs the world or we each have an angel. They have no desire for detailed knowledge of how life develops in the very diverse regions of the earth, or how its various manifestations have been formed by forces coming from the spiritual world. The intent of today's lecture, then, is to clarify some of these matters. It is precisely in these tumultuous days, when people all over the world are so utterly at a loss in the face of public affairs, when congresses and conferences take place without producing results, where, in spite of developing magnificent programs, people disperse without having come to any real decisions. It is precisely now that deeper questions should be raised about what is becoming manifest in the various regions of the earth under the guidance of the spiritual world. Consider, for example, this peninsula here, which you, Norwegians, share with the Swedes as your earthly dwelling place. You will realize that there is something about it which in a way presents a riddle to those who do not live in Sweden or Norway, but also to those who actually live here. There was certainly a great difference in how people here have thought about the tumultuous events going on in the world since 1914, compared to how people in Central Europe thought about them. These events have undoubtedly had a dreadful impact in many ways, but people today are largely unaware of their effects. They do not clarify for themselves what kind of hidden forces were at work. You are able to look south from here to Central Europe, to Southern Europe, to Africa, even to regions of Asia, and you will have observed that these events took their course in a way that went far beyond what you experienced here as their after effects and reverberations. You will have observed something flaring up from violent, elemental human passions, something that may well have perplexed you here in the North, for it really was as if people had suddenly become crazed with the desire to tear one another to pieces. To those who were onlookers only, these things must certainly have appeared most perplexing, even upon deeper reflection. But such things cannot be explained by looking only at a single time period, even a period as fraught with momentous events as this recent one. And although it is true that those who have lived through the last few years can feel as if they had navigated several centuries, it will gradually become clear that the above-mentioned statement is true. Most people today are still living and thinking exactly as they did in 1914. But in countries such as this one here in the North, things can already be understood to some extent. It is terrible that people in Central Europe still feel this way. people have undergone these events, and this is only normal, as something that can otherwise only be experienced during a span of several centuries. Everything was compressed into a few short years. You only need reflect on the fact that the events of 1914-15 embraced, within this brief space of time, as much as took place in, say, 10 years of the 30 Years' War. Nonetheless, it is possible to throw some significant light on these events if they are studied from a much wider historical perspective. And what you can observe, especially from the vantage point of your northern peninsula, is that things have been happening further south, basically since the beginning of the present age, in which your participation has actually been different from the way in which the people of Southern Europe, of Western Asia, and also of Central Europe have participated in these centuries-long events. One can certainly get an idea of the great contrasts between Southern and Northern Europe in this respect by studying specific time periods. Think, for example, of the 4th century AD, or more specifically, of the period that reached its zenith in that century. In the south, on the Greek, and especially on the Italian peninsulas, and also in the parts of Central Europe that were already closely linked with them, one can see Christianity slowly expanding. But something else can be observed as well. Christianity had made its way from the east into the pagan world of Europe, and had, during the first few centuries, established itself in a variety of ways in this pagan world. When we consider these early centuries, the 1st, 2nd, and even still the 3rd century, we find that this Christianity was imbued with an old wisdom, with a wisdom that humanity had inherited from ancient times, and that people tried to understand this Christianity through the so-called gnosis and penetrate it with the highest wisdom. This began to change in the 4th century, exactly at the time when Christianity was expanding further into the regions of Central Europe. The Gnostic, wisdom-filled understanding of Christianity disappeared. What could then be experienced was that a writer like Origen, who still attempted to bring something of the old Gnostic wisdom into Christianity, was branded as a heretic, and that Julian, the so-called apostate, who wanted to unite the old pagan wisdom with Christianity, was shunned. In the end, this led to Christianity becoming more externalized with the formation of a politically shaped church through the deed of Constantine. What had set Christianity apart? What had been so full of wisdom? What had made people realize that only the highest wisdom could discern its Christian secrets? All this began to take on a less wisdom-filled character in the 4th century. Increasingly, people were called upon to relate to Christianity with a more elementary sense, with a more abstract feeling. Christianity advanced northward from Southern Europe. Although it is true that the Christian life that developed between the 4th and the 15th centuries in the South, and especially in Central Europe, was rich in soul aspects, the actual spiritual element had receded. Gnosis was regarded as something that was no longer needed in Christianity. What has been described so far should have highlighted some of the events occurring in regions of Europe that lie further to the south. And so, Christianity was spreading, finding its way into the Greek world, the Roman world, into the life of Central Europe. And there, in a certain sense, it was stripped of spirituality. Now think of your world here in the north, say, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, that is to say, in the early years of the Christian era. This cannot really be done by means of external history, which does not offer a true account of what was happening at that time. This period must be studied with the help of anthroposophy. A number of years ago we contemplated these things in relation to the European folk souls, but today we will look at them more in relation to the external character of the peoples concerned. At the time when, in the south, the situation became such that the spirit was retreating more and more toward the east, that is to say, shortly after the period I have described, the old philosophical schools of Athens were closed, and the last of the Athenian philosophers had to make their way to the east, where they joined the mysterious academy of Gandishapur. A remarkable spiritual life was spreading at that time from this academy via Africa and southern Europe toward the rest of Europe, profoundly influencing the spiritual life of later times. It can certainly be said that there in the south, people were able to look back at what they once possessed as a lofty spirituality, that the mighty event of Golgotha had then come to pass, that in the first few centuries this sublime spirituality was still considered necessary to understand the mystery of Golgotha, that this spirituality had then gradually been displaced, and that the human element had more and more taken the place of what may be called the working of the divine in human beings. The Gnosis had still been something that helped people become conscious of the fact that there was a divine spiritual element living within them. This divine spiritual element then gradually receded, and the human element had to emerge instead. In this respect, much has been contributed by the ethnic groups and peoples who took part in the great migrations. Through their migrations toward the south, through their conquests of the southern regions, the Germanic peoples of Central Europe, whose souls were by nature more inherently bound to the physical, contributed to this repression of the spiritual, inasmuch as they did not understand the old spirituality, and brought a more basic human element to the south. And so the lofty primordial wisdom, which had once existed in human beings, receded gradually from the spiritual culture of the West. And in that same period, when this repression of the spiritual was occurring in the South, that is, in the 3rd and 4th centuries A.D., we find that up here in the North, teachings about the gods were still spreading among the inhabitants of this northern region. In that period, it was indeed still the case that those who received inspirations in an instinctive way were held in high esteem. These were times that had long since expired for the people from the southern regions. What could still be experienced up here in the north was that people would seek out and listen to certain individuals, men and women, living in solitude in out-of-the-way places, in mysterious ways, through faculties arising from their special bodily constitution. These men and women were able to give revelations concerning the spiritual worlds. Such faculties were an original, natural predisposition in these individuals, who worked in this way among their fellow human beings. And as people, large numbers of people, were listening attentively to these solitary, perceptive individuals, they were quite aware, when they went into the huts of these God-inebriated, God-imbued, God-revealing men or women, that it was not really the physical man or woman they were hearing, but rather the divine spirit itself, which had descended and was inspiring such individuals, so that they might reveal the teachings of the gods to their fellow human beings. It is very noteworthy for anyone observing European history from an anthroposophical perspective to find that during this 4th century the spirit gradually was becoming less prominent for the people in the south, and that the human element, which comes to expression in physical earthly existence, began to fill their souls instead, and became more prominent in comparison to the divine. What is worthy of note here is that while the people in the south were becoming more and more eager for human teachings, the people in the north were still so constituted during the same decisive 4th century, as to be able to receive divine teachings, and to feel that the gods, the beings of the higher hierarchies, were still living among them. It is therefore important to consider in all seriousness the isolated accounts sparkling forth from the obscure depths of spiritual life, accounts that seem to refer to a time, and this is in fact the truth, when the gods were walking as teachers among the still childlike peoples of the North. The state of affairs, which could still be encountered in a particular form in the North, during the first centuries of the Christian era, had long since passed in the South. But it certainly is remarkable, and very significant, how the destiny of the peoples had been charted in such a way that the people of the North should become the envoys for the people of the South, the bearers of what had been learned not from human beings, but from the gods. It is indeed of major importance that the people, who primarily belong to the population of the western part of your peninsula, whose descendants were the Norwegians of today, journeyed toward the west in a southwestern direction, and that as a result of their wanderings, sea voyages, and conquests, their influence reached as far south as Sicily and North Africa. The sons of the gods went to the sons of the world, bringing them in a very specific form what they had still been able to learn from their gods. It is interesting in studying history to consider these migrations of the Nordic people toward the southwest, and to observe how the elements that were still active in the teachings of the northern gods flowed in this southwestern direction, although naturally in a continually metamorphosed form, and had a profound influence on the British Isles, France, Spain, Italy, Sicily, and North Africa. The effects of this influence are actually still perceptible today. At the same time, what was making its way to the north, influenced by the Roman Latin element from the south, became permeated with the northern element. One could say that whatever remained as an awareness of the divine in this culture stream coming from the south manifested as something that had been impacted by the northern teachings of the gods. It did take on a peculiar character, however, which can only be fully appreciated if one also looks at the eastern side of this northern peninsula, at Sweden. We only need remind ourselves of a particular fact, namely how the peoples of Eastern Europe turned to the Varangians, how they became impacted by them, and how in the eastern part of this northern peninsula there was more of a leaning toward the east. The effects coming from this peninsula are quite remarkable. What later gravitates more toward the Norwegian culture, streamed toward the southwest, and what later gravitates more toward the Swedish culture, streamed toward the southeast. In all cases, however, this involved the teachings of the Nordic gods, but they were presented in different ways. It is a characteristic feature of the peoples who later became the Norwegians that they brought an active element, an element of strength and encouragement, toward the southwest. In this way, the flagging Roman Latin culture was revitalized and stimulated into activity. One can see the power of the Nordic gods working in these migrations in such a way that it stimulated the whole life of the peoples and transformed it into a more active one. This can be inferred from many specific details, and it is fascinating to study these things. But we should also note the interesting nature, perceptible even today, of the East Scandinavian influences, the Swedish impulses working in an eastern direction. This is, of course, partly due to the geographical conditions. These geographical conditions, however, must also be reflected in the character of the people, for the human being does not grow out of the earth, but is born onto the earth, having come down from worlds of soul and spirit. And it makes a difference whether one is born as a Norwegian or as a Swede. Accordingly, it does not suffice to focus only on the geographical conditions. Instead, we must investigate further why some souls have the urge to become Norwegians, while other souls have the urge to become Swedes. And so these East Scandinavian peoples streamed toward the east, but wherever they moved forward, they were continuously deflected. Their impulses could not be transformed into action. They were not able to maintain their stand against what was confronting them from the east, first from other Asiatic peoples and later from the Mongols and Tartars, nor against what was coming from the south as Christianity, as the element in early Christianity that leaned more toward the east. This impulse stream flowed toward the southeast, but met with obstacles everywhere, and as it entered into this element, assumed a more passive character. It is indeed a fact that the countries on the outer periphery were deeply impacted by what was coming from the north. But whereas the impulses flowing to the south from the western half of the northern peninsula turned into action everywhere, the impulses flowing to the east from the eastern half of the northern peninsula were seized by the inactive, more reflective element of the east, and in a certain way became dulled into inactivity. One could say that as the Nordic gods sent their impulses toward the west, they unfolded mostly their will nature, and as they sent their essential nature toward the east, they unfolded more of their reflective, contemplative, reasoning nature. External wars and conflicts are, in fact, merely the physical reflections of what is actually taking place in the way I have just indicated. Abstract theorists who view the whole world from the standpoint of some theory, and the empiricists of today, proud as they are of their science, are actually the greatest abstract theorists of all, for they never get down to realities and only want to think about things instead of knowing them from the inside. These abstract theorists will talk about all kinds of characteristics still exhibited in the Norwegians and the Swedes today. It is certainly possible to put forward all sorts of things, and the inhabitants of these northern countries themselves often emphasize the existence of such external peculiarities, simply because people today do not want to penetrate to the depths of human nature to acquire a real knowledge of life. But life must be considered in the way indicated in my two earlier lectures. In order to understand human life, also in its outer aspects, it must be viewed not only from the perspective of life between birth and death, but also from the perspective of life between death and a new birth. We must consider those things that do not really satisfy the egotism of human beings, who merely want to have a blessed existence after death and are not concerned about the life before birth because physical existence is more immediately present. We must look at these things not just from an egotistical viewpoint, but from the perspective of human life in general, from the perspective of how we can apply in this earthly life what we have brought with us through birth from worlds of soul and spirit. Then we begin to see that there are certain connections in the life of the human being and in the life of whole peoples. But these connections are only revealed when we survey what the human being experiences through many earthly lives, when we include in this overview the periods spent between death and a new birth. Then we begin to see a remarkably special connection. And by developing insight into such special connections, we are able to understand what is happening on earth. In the Norwegians of today, for example, we can still recognize traits that are legacies of what had been developed by the peoples who once migrated toward the southwest in order to activate and enliven the Roman-Latin cultural element with the revelations of their gods. At that time, something had been developed in the great plan of the world, which gave the Norwegians their special character, their particular task. And those who are born in Norway today will only be able to understand their destiny and task in the world as a whole if they look back with spiritual understanding to the period that caused Norway to develop in this special way, at the time when the northern people went on their migratory journeys, their forays, their campaigns of conquest toward the southwest, in keeping with their task on earth. This earthly task sprang from the character of the people who inhabited these countries. Admittedly, this character was very different in those times, but some of it remains as a legacy in present-day Norwegians and endows them with special faculties that have a certain significance, also from the perspective of the eternal life, the immortal life of the human being. And in the eastern part of this peninsula, where the Swedish character was developing at that time, one can observe that the old teachings of the gods were carried toward the east in a special way, which can only be described as follows. One could say that these gods migrated to the east and encountered people there who had preserved their own religious doctrines in the form of a defined oriental mysticism. Consequently, any revelations arising more out of nature were met with little response in the east, and those who wandered toward the east were destined to lead a more contemplative life. This in turn left a legacy, and this legacy has molded the character of the people. One could say that in order to understand the western and the eastern parts of the Scandinavian peninsula today, we must look back to what these people have experienced throughout the centuries, and what they have become today for the rest of the world as a result of these experiences. We have every reason at the present time to think about these things, and it is certainly possible today to grasp in a more elementary way how spiritual forces must indeed be working in the world, in the whole international course of events, in the whole life of the international community, and how the tasks of particular peoples should be understood from the viewpoint of spiritual investigation into the world situation. Now, if we approach these things with the power of supersensible cognition, if we investigate this relationship between the tasks of present-day Norwegians and Swedes and the course of their historical evolution, then it becomes apparent that there is a remarkable connection. Norwegians have a certain specific ability, and it does not strictly depend upon whether they have actually been born into a Norwegian milieu. What has been developing in this way can be seen even in the outer world. It can be described by anthropologists, historians, or even journalists. Their statements will be more or less to the point, but will not account for what really wells up in the depths of the human soul. For human beings have a mission not only here on earth. Once they have passed through death, they also have a mission with respect to the spiritual worlds. And this mission which the human being has with respect to the spiritual worlds after having passed through death develops here, precisely on the earth. What we experience in the first period following death is an outcome of human development on earth. And conversely, what we experience on the earth in the first period following birth is an outcome of the world of soul and spirit. And it is very meaningful to study with the means available to spiritual investigation in the sense of anthroposophy, the Norwegian people's mission, particularly with respect to the period after death. Souls who pass through the portal of death, particularly from the soil here in the western part of the Scandinavian peninsula, can, because of their inherent physical folk constitution and the whole configuration of the brain and the rest of the body, have the destiny to stimulate the other souls dwelling with them after death in a very specific way. I said they can have this destiny. They can give to the other souls after death something that only the Norwegian folk character is able to impart. For the Norwegian character is, especially at the present time, so constituted that it gets to know certain secrets of nature in a subconscious and inner way, that is, not through external intellectual knowledge, but through the kind of knowledge that you develop in your spirit-body existence between the time of falling asleep and waking, when you are outside in space, without making use of your physical senses. When, outside of your body, you experience the spirit in the plant world, the spirit in stone and rock, the spirit in the rustling of the trees and the sounds of the ocean, when you perceive them not with your senses, but see them from outside your body, when you walk in their realms between falling asleep and waking up, then you become aware of mighty forces. Then you become aware of the real forces living in the plants, the real forces hidden in the rocks, the real forces in the ocean waves breaking in upon the shore. If you take all this that is the spirit of the roaring waves, the spirit of the sparsely flowering plants on the rocks, the spirit of this entire world ensemble, if you take everything that this world ensemble triggers in your souls during sleep, that is to say, if you take the intimate knowledge of nature, which remains completely unconscious to the intellect and the senses, then you have here the element that you can carry into the spiritual world, provided you imbue it with the right kind of devotion and feeling, as I described in the last lecture. And when you then create the right connection between it and the spiritual world, as you are able to grasp it, and develop what I have called the relationship with your angel being, then you will carry into the spiritual world this unconscious nature wisdom, this concrete knowledge of the spirit of the plants, this concrete knowledge of the spirit of the stones and of all the other phenomena in nature. Those who have, in a true sense, experienced living their Norwegian life become the inspirers of their fellow souls after death, the teachers of the secrets of nature here on the earth. For in the spiritual world, souls must be taught about the secrets of the earth, just as here on the earth they must be taught about the secrets of the spiritual world. And if we consider the eastern half of this peninsula, where the influences from olden times are still present in the way I have described, then we find that in those regions a different mission is carried through the portal of death. What souls carry through death into the spiritual world in those regions is not so much what is experienced between falling asleep and waking up, but rather what is experienced more through the senses during waking consciousness while connecting to the external world. What is experienced in the observation and contemplation of the outer world during waking life, and in a feeling-imbued rational understanding of this world. But this is actually something which, strictly speaking, only has significance for life on earth. Yet it is precisely when the human being is developing this particular element in earthly life that something very special develops during this earthly life in the subconscious realm. I have pointed out to you that even in waking life, a certain part of our being sleeps and dreams. The life of feeling is actually only another form of dream life. Inasmuch as we feel, we dream, and inasmuch as we use our will, we sleep. What we know about our will is only what our thinking illumines, but the will that is ignited in the Swedish soul is the kind of will that has less opportunity to penetrate the secrets of nature during sleep. What enters the Swedish soul's will and feeling more unconsciously during the act of perceiving and of rationally contemplating the outer world, this is what is carried through the portal of death. As a result, the souls who pass through death from the eastern part of the Scandinavian peninsula, in the way described, actually have the mission to impart to their fellow souls an element related more to the will, exactly the opposite of what these northern peoples from eastern Scandinavia were able to impart to their physical fellow human beings while connected with them in historical times. One could say that this special ability related to the element of will has been developed in the eastern part of the Scandinavian peninsula, first as a primary quality, and subsequently as an inherited part of the folk character. The people of Europe have lived for a long time without asking, in a concrete sense, what they should actually devote themselves to after death. For they have felt quite content with the egotistical answer, "We shall be blessed." But if the world is not to fall into complete decadence, it will not suffice to merely receive this kind of egotistical answer. It will only be possible for people to lead their lives in the right way if they are willing to accept a selfless answer, when they not only ask, quote, "How will things be after death, so that we shall be happy and blessed," close quote, but when they also ask, quote, "What am I called upon to do in view of my particular situation in earthly life?" Close quote. It is only when people are inclined to treat this question in this way that they will be able to use their situation in life appropriately, and hence prepare themselves for their mission in the right way. Then it will no longer be difficult to prepare for this mission in this way. In this sense, the two lectures, or indeed all three lectures, which I was privileged to hold here for you, are all connected. It is absolutely essential, particularly taking into account this special mission, that the spiritual element in the anthroposophical understanding of the world be understood here in Norway. For if you consider that it is certainly a special task to create out of the subconscious life what I would call a natural science for the hereafter, however paradoxical this may seem, it is nonetheless true, then you must prepare yourself here, in your conscious life, by involving your feelings. Then your soul must be given the opportunity to fall asleep every night in such a way that it will not be unreceptive to the insights into nature that will be transmitted to it during sleep. But today human bodies are no longer so constituted that they allow for this process of preparation. The souls of the northern peoples are, through their ancient heritage, fundamentally suited for the spiritual world. Here, above all, human bodies must be prepared for this through a culture of the spirit. And so a decisive question arises at this point. It is a question that can be clarified for us by comparing the mission of, say, the peoples of Central Europe with that of the peoples of the North. There is a book that describes the current state of affairs for the people in Central Europe. It is described not badly at all for those who do not accept anything spiritual, by a man who gave no thought to the possibility of a spiritual enrichment of humanity. Oswald Spengler wrote his book titled The Decline of the West. It is a brilliant but thoroughly pessimistic book, even though he did repudiate this pessimism in a subsequent special booklet. Describing the decline of the West can, of course, only be pessimistic. But Spengler is actually speaking of the decline of culture, the decline of something that belongs to the realm of the soul. Without spiritual regeneration, the people of Central Europe will suffer injury to their souls. But here, in this corner of Northern Europe, we have the peculiar circumstance that when human beings are injured in their soul, it is not just the soul, but in fact their whole bodily nature that is injured at the same time. I have to say, though, what good fortune this is. For if the people of Central Europe do not accept the spiritual, then they become less human. Then they degenerate in soul. The northern people, on the other hand, can only die in a bodily sense, die out. For everything here depends on the special constitution of the body, as described. It is absolutely necessary at this time to consider this much-needed influence of a culture of the spirit. Central Europe will degenerate, will become less human, will be heading toward its own decline if it does not let itself be impacted by the spirit. Northern Europe will die out, will suffer physical death, if it does not let itself be influenced by the spirit. And so, seen from the perspective of the northern people, there is a direct connection between what is developed here during physical life and the mission of these northern souls after death. They will not be able to fulfill this mission if they allow their bodies to degenerate. These bodies are so well adapted for this mission, provided they are imbued with spirit. It is necessary today to speak words of such a serious nature, for it is very much in line with the evolution of our age that we speak together of such matters, if we are to take this age, our time, in earnest. And it is for this very reason that I wanted to speak to you this time from the general, personal, human standpoint, to say to you what one says to one's fellow human beings on earth if one is profoundly concerned about the destiny of the evolution of the earth. For those who do not prepare themselves selflessly for an eternal life, will not be leading their earthly life between birth and death in the right way either. This is what I wanted to leave with you, now that we have completed this last lecture, during my time here in your midst. I wanted you to take note of the fact that those who perceive themselves as anthroposophists today should feel that even as a tiny handful of people in this world, they should indeed apply all their energy to arousing the rest of humanity out of its lethargy and helping it move forward. Those who hate anthroposophy today, and it should be possible to say this among ourselves, hate it because they feel too contented to truly empathize and get involved with the great tasks of humanity, because they are too fearful of what they would have to overcome if they are to reshape their habitual way of thinking and feeling in order to understand something much more profound. This is why we see many a storm of opposition emerging against whatever is happening within the field of anthroposophy and developing as an outcome of it. You too will have to become accustomed to the undeniable fact that anthroposophic spiritual science will be vehemently attacked by people who do not want to move forward, who love to stay with their old routines. And those who let this kind of opposition deter them from developing their own forces are not really grounded in the actual tasks of anthroposophy. When we see how anthroposophy is attacked today from all sides, we could, on the one hand, become apprehensive and fearful and say, quote, "Would it not be better to proceed less forcefully, so that the opposition would perhaps be slighter?" Close quote. It is, however, possible to say something very different. For if, alternatively, we find that praise is doled out by people who in this decadent age hold leading positions, then we could say, quote, "What have we in reality done wrong?" Close quote. This question should really be asked from the anthroposophical point of view. If we are attacked and insulted, then this can generally be explained based on the reasons given above. But if praise were to come from the same quarters, then this would be very unfortunate indeed, for it would mean that our anthroposophical striving is in a bad state. It is precisely because the opponents of anthroposophy today are attacking it that we can feel reassured, but only, of course, in the sense that we must apply all the more energy in order to accomplish for the world what anthroposophy is meant to accomplish, not out of personal arbitrariness, but out of a deep realization of the needs and tasks of the world. And it is out of this feeling, out of this impulse, that I would like to conclude our working together here by expressing my deepest, heartfelt thanks for your active and energetic cooperation in everything that had to transpire here with you at this time. Please rest assured that I mean it seriously when I say that separation in space is no separation to those who know the reality of the spiritual bond between souls. Please rest assured that in taking my leave, I do so not to be away from you, but in order to remain together with you. And this is something which I believe you can always hold in your souls, if you consider it desirable and wish this to be the case. You may be quite sure that there are already quite a few people in the world who feel a bond in this sense and who look with love in their hearts toward this region in the north with its very special task, the importance of which can also be keenly sensed in the field of anthroposophic research. I take leave of you with this love in my heart for those who feel that they truly belong to us, to our anthroposophic movement. May our subsequent togetherness, too, be full of an inner strength and be carried by an awareness that is needed and right among anthroposophists. The end of Lecture 3.